We're going to look now at a very famous and, for our study, fairly early case, that of William of Saint-Calais. I'm Sarah White, and with me to speak about the case is John Hudson. So, John, could you tell us a bit about the case, what the date was, and where it took place?
Okay, we're at the end of the 11th century in England, and when William Rufus comes to the throne of England in 1087, his position was insecure. In particular, his older brother, Robert, Duke of Normandy, had a claim to the throne. Rufus faced a very serious rebellion in England in 1088, and that's the political setting of this case.
And who are the parties in the case?
So on one side, we have the king, William Rufus, who I've already mentioned. On the other, we have the Bishop of Durham, William of St. Calais. William of St. Calais had been a loyal servant of Rufus's father, William the Conqueror, and may well have had an important role in the Domesday Survey of 1086.
And what was the issue that these two men were disputing?
The king saw the bishop as having deserted him during the rebellion early in 1088. He ordered the bishop's arrest and dispossessed him of his and his church's lands. The bishop avoided capture himself and took shelter in Durham Castle.
So already we have a case here that is much more high profile than some of the cases we've looked at before. We have a king and a bishop and refuge in castles. So in a case like this, what kind of procedural steps do we see?
Interestingly, the procedural arguments are similar to ones we would have in low-level cases as well, certainly later. Though you're absolutely right, the high-level interpersonal politics and the potential military element obviously are very different. The bishop repeatedly insists that he'd offer the king justice according to his order, that means as a churchman, but only if the king would restore him to his lands, of which he'd been unjustly disseised. The king, on the other hand, requires him to be tried as a layman and exerts pressure by laying waste to some of the bishop's lands, giving others away, and imprisoning his messengers. Then we get one of these political elements that you mentioned earlier. Eventually, the bishop reaches an agreement with three of the king's leading men. And the agreement's as follows. The king was to do him justice according to the law of the bishop. If the judgment went against him, he and his men were to have safe conduct to leave the country. Now, this sounds a very good settlement for the Bishop of Durham. He's got his point about being tried according to the law of the bishop, according to church law. On the other hand, we have to remember that the source for this is a Durham text. It is a justification of William's position. A hearing then takes place in the King's Court at Salisbury on the 2nd and 3rd of November 1088.
Are there any particularly interesting arguments that are made after the case begins?
So, in court, the bishop again repeatedly draws on canon law. He emphasises, for example, that he'd not been summoned canonically. Any judgment must be correct canonically and, again, according to his order. He shouldn't be judged by laymen. He requests that the king should return his bishopric to him. It had been taken away, he says, without judgment. The Latin is sine judicio, a phrase familiar in the later writ of Novodicesium. Either it should be shown that the bishop should plead whilst despoiled, or he should be canonically invested with his bishopric and only then answer. Here, therefore, we have the bishop using the so-called exceptio spoli, the argument, or the exception as they call it, that a case shouldn't proceed while the party making the exception has been despoiled.
And this is similar to what we see in more perhaps low-level canon law cases as well. There's a lot of emphasis on correct procedure, especially on summons, and this idea that one cannot properly sue if you've been despoiled of your property.
That's exactly right.
So what other arguments appear then in the same case?
Interestingly, the person bringing the king's case, stating the king's case, is another churchman, Archbishop Lanfranc, and is another churchman who is expert in canon law. Lanfranc seems to have brought his canon law collection, based on the so-called pseudo-Isidorian decretals, with him to England from Normandy when he became archbishop in 1070. He drew on this text in various situations, possibly including this trial in 1088. And it's also on the pseudo-Isidorian decrees that Bishop William relied. Now, we know that Bishop William bequeathed to his cathedral, to Durham, a book called Decrees of the Pontiffs, Decreta Pontificum. And what this is, perhaps ironically, is a copy of Lanfranc's collection, which is now preserved in the library of Peterhouse College, Cambridge. In this manuscript, passages upon which Bishop William based his arguments in 1088 have got marks by them in the margins. Now, we can't be certain that they are William's own marks, but they may well be marks that he made whilst constructing his arguments.
That's really fantastic. That's honestly the dream for anyone who's looking to discover how arguments were drafted and how litigants were constructing their cases in court. And very rarely do we have any sort of marginal notation that seems specific to one particular case. So that's really, really interesting. It's also interesting that both parties are relying on the pseudo-Isidorian decrees, because these are the same texts that the idea of the Actio Spolii is based on in canon law. So this is really interesting to see this idea being used this early in actual litigation. How is the judgment made in this case?
Here we have the return of the political pressures and the king continuing to press for the surrender of Durham Castle. Eventually, the bishop gives the king sureties, pledges, as the king had demanded, and in return was given permission to leave the realm once the king had control of Durham Castle. The bishop says that he's acting out of necessity, an indication that he views this outcome as contrary to the normal requirements of canon law. Necessity justifies actions outside the usual norms. The king, meanwhile, was intent on preventing the bishop from leaving the realm because of his intention to appeal to the Pope.
And what was the outcome of the case?
The struggle continues a bit, and following the intervention of those same leading men who'd participated in the earlier agreement, the bishop was eventually allowed to sail from Southampton early in December 1088. But as we've been saying, this was very largely a matter of politics, and in 1092, he's reconciled with the king, reconciled with William Rufus, and restored to his bishopric. And in the following year, the bishop begins the building of the cathedral at Durham, which stands to this day.
Thanks, that's really interesting.